Fifth case this morning, United States versus Stevenson.
Morning, Your Honor. Jerry Bischoff for the appellant.
Bishop. And Mr. Alexis. Ms. Alexis. All right, Mr. Bischoff, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jerry Bischoff. I represent the appellant in this case. What we're doing here, Your Honor, is we're challenging one of the predicate offenses upon which his 15-year sentence was based. He was sentenced as an armed career criminal. I think really the reason that we're here comes down to the Illinois Department of Correction records. They're not very helpful. We can tell from those records that Mr. Stevenson was admitted into the IDOC March of 1994, when he picked up a UW by a felon case, 94 CR 1805. The judge who sentenced him to 3 years in that case ordered that sentence to run concurrent with an attempt murder from 1989.
You said concurrent, Mr. Bischoff, you meant consecutive?
No, I'll talk about the consecutive sentences. We're talking about the two cases that he entered the IDOC at the time he was discharged. He entered in March of 1994 on a UUW and the attempt murder from 1989, and those were to run concurrently. He was subsequently discharged on March 15th of 1996. So the question is, was he discharged on just the UUW alone, or was he discharged on both those cases, the UUW as well as the attempt murder? And I'm gonna take a step backward in a minute, but just to lay some background, that's why we're here, because we can't tell from the IDOC records whether he was discharged on the UUW alone or whether possibly discharged on more than one case. And again, that brings us back to the records, the restoration of rights letter that he would have received. We know from the records that they're triggered automatically when you are discharged out. We can tell from the offender tracking system and the document that the government relied on, the minimus and movement screen, that he was discharged out on March 15th, 1996. The problem with those documents is they don't correlate to a particular crime. Doesn't say he discharged out on the UUW, doesn't say he discharged out on the attempt murder, doesn't say he discharged out on both. And that's a problem with the OTS and the screen. The restoration rights letter is problematical because it doesn't identify which case he's receiving the letter on. And of course, as was discussed at length in Buckmeyer, we know that letter is a problem for a host of reasons. One is it doesn't inform the offender that although his principal civil rights have been restored, that he can't own or possess a weapon. If you receive that letter, if it applies to the attempt murder in this case, then it can't be relied upon as a predicate offense under the Armed Career Criminal Act. Now, that's by way of background. So I want to just shift briefly to what happened here with Judge Tharp. And he admitted during sentencing that these documents are not very helpful, that they certainly are lacking in clarity, which is why he had to go through his own calculations to determine when that attempt murder sentence was complete in his mind. And what he did was And one of the justices asked me about consecutive, and that's key here, because that attempt murder case that under 89 CR 8636 back in 1989 was ordered to run consecutive to a drug case in 89 CR 8932. It was, in effect, a 10-year sentence. The mistake that Judge Tharp sentences as concurrent instead of consecutive. And when he did the math, and what he did was he considered the 226 days time considered served that he received on that attempt murder. He moved backwards from when the sentence would have started, and then he calculated when the sentence for the attempt murder might have ended. He actually made a mistake because he picked the December 1st, 1989 date instead of the November 15th date on which he was actually sentenced, but that was only a few weeks. He concluded that when Mr. Stevenson, I'm sorry, this is so confusing. There's a lot of math involved and it's hard to follow. So I hope you interrupt me with questions, because he paroled out in April 17th of 1994. And you can see that in Defendant Exhibit C, which is Appendix 99, which indicates that he paroled out on April 17th, 1995. And again, the problem is you can't tell what case he paroled out on. But Judge Tharp concluded—
Mr. Bischoff, I'll take you up on your invitation.
Please do.
The point that you're making, you're not going to like me to hear. You're not going to like me saying it this way, but you can disagree with me. Okay. The point that you're making strikes me as absolutely correct. You can't tell. But that's exactly the problem that Mr. Stevenson runs into here, because he unfortunately bears the burden. So I think the only direction that he can approach this from is to try to prove that, not only try to establish that Judge Tharp's construction of all this, or attempt to reconstruct it, is erroneous. It reflects clear errors. And that his alternative, meaning Mr. Stevenson's alternative, is the only sensible alternative construction. Unless he can get to that point, I don't see how he can carry his burden. And I say that recognizing how unfortunate this situation is, that nobody can come up with an answer to a question that you would think we could answer.
Well, I think we can answer it. And I think that we have met our burden by a preponderance of the evidence. And this is, I'm glad you asked that question and framed it the way you did. It's going to make it a little easier for me. And I was trying to wind my way to that point. The Judge Tharp's calculation was wrong. And he admitted, in essence, he admitted that this was a consecutive sentence, not a concurrent sentence. So whatever calculation he arrived at is wrong. But here's what you can tell. You do have to go back and kind of recreate the sentence, because the jail, they don't maintain their master files. So you kind of have to figure out what would typically regularly happen. Maybe it's the presumption of regularity that we can apply here as well. What should have happened? His sentence for the attempt murder should not have started running until his sentence, his four-year sentence for the drug case, was complete.
Mr. Bischoff, I don't know if you can hear me, but you're not coming through.
Oh, no. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to speak a little. Maybe I'm too loud, and I'm going to speak a little slower. I've calculated that the four-year sentence that he was serving on his drug case under 89 CR 8932 would have been complete on March 6, 1993, taking into consideration the 152 days he had time considered served.
Okay, there's a premise, though. There's a premise there that's important. How do you know when he receives consecutive sentences for the 1989 offenses, plural, the drug offense and the attempted murder? How do we know, or how do we answer, which sentence he started serving first?
We can answer that because when he picked up the UUW case, the judge in that case ordered that he serve his three-year sentence on W concurrent with the attempt murder. So you know that he had to have served his drug case first. And note this, it's important. His drug case sentence was up on March 6, 1993. So he violated his parole after that was already complete. And that's one of the things about the OTS, which is wrong. You could read it as saying when he was paroled out on April 17th, 1995, if you look at the MIT sentence information, it would seem to indicate he was paroled out on, or at least discharged out, anywhere you want to put it, on three cases, when two of those cases' sentences were complete years
earlier. So that's why you say that, that's why you word it the way you did, where you said Judge Tharp is wrong. And the reason Judge Tharp is wrong, in your view, is because of what the state court judge said at the time he was paroled out on the state gun charge.
Exactly. And I don't want to speak anecdotally. Having done enough state work in my life, I know how these things work, and I know how these sentences work and how they should work. Now, assuming I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but assuming I'm right, his attempt murder sentence that he was running, that was running concurrent with the UUW case, the maximum, it would have expired, in other words, in June of 1998. And the concurrent UUW would have expired on March 15th of 1997. Both of those sentences, running concurrent, extended beyond the time that he discharged out on March 15th, 1996. So again, I don't know why the jail let him out before the expiration of his maximum sentence on either of those cases, but I think it's safe to presume that jail did it on both cases rather than just one. It's more likely than not that it happened that way. No IDOC record disputes this. I think
More likely that he was discharged out on both of those sentences? Is it follow from your argument, Mr. Bischoff, because you say those sentences would have expired past 96, that therefore it
both
must have
of been them. Yes, sir. Both of them would have passed that date. So it's safe to assume that the jail maybe earned credit, good time. I don't, you know, without the master file, you can't be sure, but you can be sure that both sentences is extended beyond the discharge date. And it's a fair assumption then that both sentences discharged out on the same day. And there's no document that would contradict that. But what I can say is that Judge Tharp was wrong. He treated a consecutive sentence as concurrent, and that was clear error. So I don't know if I have any time left, anything to reserve, but I think I should wrap it up about here.
Yes, you should. Ms. Alexis?
Good morning, judges. May it please the court, this is Georgia Alexakis representing the United States. This court should affirm Mr. Stevenson's sentence. The government concedes that the IDOC records that everyone has wrestled over are clearly not a model of clarity. And yet, with the record before it, the district court correctly determined that the defendant was an armed career criminal, where Mr. Stevenson was unable to meet his burden to establish by preponderance of the evidence that the IDOC had sent him a restoration of rights letter that related to either of his 1989 convictions.
Ms. Alexakis, can we hear your response to Mr. Bischoff's point about a fair assumption that both of the UUW and the other sentence expired after the discharge?
And Your Honor, my response to that is to simply point the court to the defendant's mitimus, which has a 4/17/1995, an April 17th, 1995 discharge date for both the attempted murder and for the other 1989 conviction, his drug-related conviction. So while I understand where Mr. Bischoff is coming from, that logically these two sentences that have been ordered to serve consecutively, one would expect that at least one of those sentences would have extended past April 17th, 1995. And yet the records before us all indicate that the attempted murder conviction ended, that Mr. Stevenson was discharged from that sentence on April 17th, 1995. We also know that he wasn't discharged from parole at that time. We know that because there's no discharge from a particular location, and the Heard affidavit, which is part of the record below, made clear, and this was an undisputed affidavit, that per IDOC records, if someone is going to be discharged from parole, there's going to be a notation of a particular location from which the inmate is discharged. Here, all we have is that 4/17/95 discharge date, no corresponding institution. Judge Tharp went through painstaking calculations where he calculated that, you know, that the days of that sentence for the attempted murder did add up to an expiration of April 17, 1995. So there could not have been a parole from that attempted murder conviction. There could not have been a discharge from a particular location. And under those conditions, the unchallenged Heard affidavit told the district court that a restoration of rights letter simply would not have been issued.
Do you think Judge Tharp misunderstood in any way that the 1989 convictions resulted in consecutive sentences?
I don't, Judge. I don't think that Judge Tharp misunderstood that. That question clearly came up at the sentencing hearing. I believe Judge Tharp expressly acknowledged the argument. I think he conceded that the argument gave him, quote, a little pause, were the words that he used. And yet he went on to explain that based on his calculations, based on the record before it, he still believed that defendant had not met his burden in establishing that the letter that he would have received or would have been sent in 1996 following his discharge would have only applied to the 1994 UUW offense and not to either of the 1989 convictions.
Do you claim that the merchants sent out discharge letters?
I'm sorry, Judge Keeney, you cut out a bit for me there.
The Department of Corrections, do you claim that the Department of Corrections sent those discharge letters?
The government concedes that a discharge letter would have been sent to the defendant in 1996, in March of 1996, but it's the government's position that that letter would have only applied to his 1994 UUW offense and neither of the 1989 convictions. And I think that presumption fits both the facts of the case and also fits with the case law, where this court has held in a number of cases that restoration of rights letters, the default assumption is that they're case-specific, that they're conviction-specific.
Ms. Alexakis, jumping off on that idea of our case law, obviously this court went on Bonk and Buckmeyer, we have Burnett, we have Boyce. One of the threads of the case law is the anti-mousetrapping, the interpretation of the unless clause in subsection 20. Is it possible here to rule for the government but still be true to that anti-mousetrapping rationale or the obverse?
I think so, Judge. I think that the court has interpreted that clause to place the burden on the defendant. And I think, you know, typically I'm well familiar with how high the burden tends to be for the government typically in criminal cases. But in this case, we're dealing with what this court has interpreted in light of the language of the statute as an affirmative defense. And so it's the defendant who bears the burden in this instance. And so in light of that case law, in light of the record, and in particular, again, the fact that the documents before the district court clearly indicated that the defendant had discharged from his, was discharged on April 17th, 1995 for the sentences related to his 1989 convictions, the government maintains that the district court here did not clearly err in making its finding that Mr. Stevenson qualified as an armed career criminal. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I simply ask that Mr. Stevenson's sentence be affirmed.
I have one quick question. It's quite unrelated, and it's this. You don't have to know the answer, but I'm more curious, and maybe Mr. Bischoff knows. Is Illinois still send these letters out today?
Your Honor, I don't want to speak out of
turn. My question was going to be, there's been an awful lot of resources that have been expended, and I completely understand why Mr. Stevenson has pressed this point. But this all starts from the deficiency with these letters and this paperwork to begin with. And sure. That's unfortunate for everybody, most especially Mr. Stevenson.
Judge, I don't disagree with the comment that you made about the unfortunate situation that we're all in. I will say that from conversations that I've had with colleagues, my understanding is that the situation has improved, and that situations like this, like what Mr. Stevenson is facing, are exceedingly rare simply because the process has changed, and you know, we're aging out of defendants with convictions that are this old. I think that's what I can say.
Thank you.
Mr. Bischoff, did you want to say something? Mr. Bischoff?
Okay, I'm sorry. I went out there for a second. Just in answer to Justice's earlier question, they are still sending out the letter, but I would let you know that it's been vastly improved finally. The one at issue was being sent 92 to 2001 without being changed, and that's the time frame we're within. In reply, I just want to say one thing. I just want to say what the district court said when I pointed out the consecutive nature of the sentence. He said, now all of that said, I think you make some interesting points about the concurrent and consecutive nature of some of these sentences. And that gives me a little pause, because while I acknowledge that they were consecutive sentences, I think that the coincidence of that sentence being exactly a 6-year sentence on the discharge date is a very large coincidence. But it does highlight the fact that we don't know exactly what's happening in the brew there of how these three sentences actually got executed. This is a guy doing 15 years. Based on a coincidence. And I have a real problem with that. So I hope the court will take a very close look at these arguments, how I believe these sentences really should have been carried out. And I'd ask that the court reverse and remand.
Thank you, Mr. Bush. Thank you, Mr. Alexis. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and remove.